is your trademark now. You didn't do it
before. Hammer, pound, and nails.
The problem we ran into is that we had to hug old people.
The Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications will be in order. I'd first like to welcome all our guests into the room. It looks like a full house. Thank you for coming, and I'd especially like to welcome the Cooperative Network that's here. Thank you all. And there's actually just a little plug here for your reception tonight at the Best Western Kelly Inn at 4:30. So maybe we can bop over there after this committee is done. So thank you very much for the invite, and thank you for coming, and to everybody else who is in the audience. We have Senate File 86 in front of us today, and it is the coal moratorium bill. So we are going to have testimony all day today, and the plan is to continue testimony on Tuesday next week and have a final vote with that bill. So I am the chief author, and I will be turning the gavel over to Senator Jungbauer. And with that, see you in a minute.
All right, we have before us Senate File 86, Senator Rosen.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. You've all heard of that expression. 07 was a really great year for Chardonnay or California wines or something like that. Well, 2007 was a great year for energy. We did a tremendous amount of work, and many of you in this room were a part of that work on energy, and we passed the Next Gen Act in 07. And basically it did two things. It had two goals. Number one, to establish the renewable energy standard, which was to have 25% excuse me, 25% of our renewables by the year 2025. And then also it reduced the per capita use of the fossil fuels by 15% by the year 2015. So that was very aggressive. It also we adjusted the Conservation Improvement Program, the CIP program, from a spending requirement to a savings requirement. So as you all know, we've had our testifying on that, and we have the 1.5% goal for the annual retail energy sales for all the utilities. And we also adjusted the CBED statutes, the Community-Based Energy Development Statutes. So those were some very good, aggressive goals that we did. And very, like I said, we should be very proud of that. And I hope Senator Anderson comes here pretty soon, because she had a lot to do with that. And Senator Pretner Solon had a lot to do with that. And I was actually on the conference committee for that. And with anything, though, once in a while, you get a bad smelly cork, and you need to go back and adjust a few things. And that's what we have with the coal moratorium. The Senate File 86 basically repeals the ban on the construction of new coal-fired power plant in Minnesota. It repeals the ban on importation of coal from another state or Canada. And it also deals with the, well, that's about it, really, for that part. So the reason I voted for this bill back in 07 is because there was a lot of things in place that were supposed to happen that did not happen. And those are really crucial. And we were told that the off-ramps were sufficient in this bill. And the utilities supported this reasoning. The off-ramps that were in the bill never really materialized, Mr. Chair. The PUC hasn't established a clear set of criteria, and they have been forced to pass off the first real challenge to the administrative law judge, and that's actually dealing with Great River Energy. We are also told that the National Regional Greenhouse Gas Reduction Program would be in place. That also has not materialized, and that's very important. Thank you very much. And even if one of the East and West Coast carbon markets are accessed, the cost will be prohibitive I'm sorry, I got to put my glasses on. This is the problem. Okay. The cost will be prohibitive and result in a de facto ban on new baseload power from coal. So basically, the coal moratorium is from the law that was enacted in 07. And as I said, it restricts the construction within the state of a new electric power generating plant of 50 megawatts capacity or more. It restricts the import and commits to import from outside the state power from such a plant or enter into a long-term power purchase agreement that would increase statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions. The statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions is defined and includes emissions caused by generation of electricity in another state if the electricity is consumed in Minnesota. So that's what it basically means. The moratorium expires on the date, this is what the law says, when there is effect a state law or rule pertaining to greenhouse gases that directly limits or substantially reduces over time statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions. Therefore, we have Senate File 86. And it may be at some point the construction of a coal-powered electric generating plant in Minnesota is the best choice for Minnesota and for public interest members. And current law does not allow for this to occur. It's not responsible and it's not reasonable. And we need to do something about this. So with that, Mr. Chair and members, I think we'd like to bring up my first witness, and that would be Mr. Eric Olson, who's the Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Olson. If you'd please identify yourself for the tape.
Yes, good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Eric Olson, and I am the Vice President and General Counsel of Great River Energy. Excuse me. For those of you who don't know Great River, we are a generation and transmission electric cooperative headquartered in Maple Grove. We serve and are owned by 28 Minnesota electric distribution cooperatives who in turn serve member consumers who make up about one-third of Minnesota's population and occupy about two-thirds of Minnesota's geographic area. I am here to express Great River Energy's support for the passage of Senate File 86. Although the economic downturn has slowed growth in the use of electricity, that could turn around in a very short time, and Minnesota would need cost-effective baseload generation. Why would Minnesota want to prohibit what might be the very best option at the time we need more power? And why would we want to prohibit or make more costly new power plants that are much cleaner and more efficient than existing plants? We think regulation of greenhouse gas emissions should occur solely at the national level. We don't need a separate Minnesota law. The US EPA has already adopted regulations under the Clean Air Act that require best available control technology for CO2 emissions for new plants and major modifications of existing plants. We also think that the very stringent federal regulation of other emissions from coal plants has made coal-fired generation electricity very clean. And pending and proposed federal regulations will make coal even cleaner. You'll hear from opponents of Senate File 86 that they think coal-fired electric generation is a bad thing. We couldn't disagree more. Minnesota receives over 60% of its electric energy from coal-fired power plants. Electric energy from coal plants is the foundation of the affordable electric rates and reliable service enjoyed by Minnesota families, farms, and businesses. But regardless of your opinion about coal, it's important to remember that Senate File 86 doesn't somehow open the floodgates for new coal plants. It merely places coal plants back to where they were before 2007, meaning new coal plants will be subject to the exceedingly stringent environmental and financial hurdles contained in Minnesota's existing Certificate of Need law. Minnesota should not go it alone in placing severe restrictions on coal plants. Why increase costs and put Minnesota's competitiveness at risk with no benefit in return when other states have not followed suit? One of the provisions of the current law bars importation of electricity from new coal plants in other states unless the emissions are offset by reducing an existing facility's CO2 emissions or by purchasing CO2 allowances from a regional CO2 market. We don't think it makes sense to classify something made in one state as an import and impose restrictions or additional costs on its use in another state. When we say we're part of the United States, one of the things that we mean is that we are united in commerce. The existing statute has created several issues that make determining how to plan for complying with it impossible, and therefore place what Senator Rosen called a de facto ban on new coal-fired power plants. The statute's general exemption provision exempts plants, only plants that are, quote, essential, an impossible standard to meet and one that conflicts with the required showing of need under Minnesota's Certificate of Need statute. Another significant issue relates to the statutory provision that allows utilities to offset CO2 emissions from existing facilities against the CO2 emissions from new plants that are subject to the statute. Great River Energy is in the very early stages of a proceeding at the Minnesota PUC regarding our plan to offset emissions at our New Spiritwood Station coal-fired combined heat and power plant near Jamestown, North Dakota, with reduction in emissions from other facilities. Construction of Spiritwood is complete, and we expect it to go online January 1st, 2012. Spiritwood is a 99-megawatt plant that will generate electricity, but will also produce steam to provide the energy needs of Cargill's adjacent malting facility under a 30-year contract. Spiritwood is a state-of-the-art facility, built during the recession with the help of many Minnesota contractors and many Minnesota workers. When Spiritwood's steam capacity is fully subscribed, it will emit CO2 at about the same rate as gas-fired peaking plants, which are exempt from the statute. In addition, because Spiritwood uses best available pollution control technology, its sulfur dioxide and NOx emissions will be a small fraction of those at some older coal-fired plants, and particulate emissions will be completely controlled. When the U.S. EPA finalizes its maximum available control technology standard for mercury, which is expected to occur by the end of this year and require mercury to be 90% controlled, Spiritwood will emit only 8 to 10 pounds of mercury per year. Great River Energy has reduced our CO2 emissions from other facilities by an amount that is more than sufficient to offset CO2 emissions from the energy Great River Energy will import into Minnesota from Spiritwood. We expected we would be able to use these offsets when we chose to go forward with Spiritwood after the statute was passed in 2007. But no one can agree on what the statute's offset provisions mean. So the PUC has referred the matter to a contested case hearing. One of the issues with the statute's offset provision is the requirement that offsets don't qualify if they would have otherwise occurred. We don't operate utilities in a vacuum. Decisions we make often have several major factors behind them. The interpretation of would not have otherwise occurred offered by avowed opponents of coal plants in our contested case proceeding make it difficult to imagine any offset proposal that would qualify. The point here is not to argue the PUC case in front of this body. This is not the forum for that. The point instead is that the application of the offset language in the existing statute to any set of facts is impossible to predict. We expect resolution of the contested case will take several months and may not be resolved until the case is heard by appellate courts. If Great River Energy's offset plan isn't approved, we will have to purchase CO2 emissions from the regional CO2 markets in the Northeast or California. What's worse is we have no idea how much the CO2 allowances will cost during the years we have to purchase them. The total cost to Minnesota electric co-op member consumers could rise to $20 million per year for no benefit in exchange. Great River Energy believes that such a wealth transfer from Minnesotans to other states makes no sense. For all of the foregoing reasons, Great River Energy supports the passage of Senate File 86. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to start just with kind of an information question, and I apologize for being late. I ran into a neighbor on the way here. And I don't have a very good excuse, but you have to say hi to your neighbor. The gist of this bill, or a big part of this bill, is the repealer, and we don't have that language in front of us, do we? I'd like to, if we don't, I don't see it in my packet, I'd like to request that we have copies of Section 3 of the bill, of the law in front of us, if someone could make copies of that, because I want to make sure everyone on the committee understands what we're discussing, if we could ask that to be distributed.
That would be helpful. Great.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and perhaps Council could just go through that request verbally, why we're getting copies for Senator Anderson.
Great. Thank you.
Okay,
we have a copy here, and we'll make them available, but we'll care to go through what the repealer is verbally as we're, or is it something we need to sit and read, do you think, while we're looking at it? We don't want to hold up any testimony, so we're trying to figure out the best way to move this along. Jessica, can you explain what the repealer 216H03, I think it is?
Mr. Chairman, members, that's what Senator Rosen described. That is the coal moratorium
so it's
law. With the exceptions, with the definitions of what statewide power sector greenhouse gas emissions are, with the prohibition on the actions that would increase statewide power sector greenhouse gas emissions through power plants and power purchases, two or three subdivisions that provide exemptions for facilities, a steel plant, I think a nugget plant, and an enforcement section, and then a general exemption section, which is the section that the witness was just testifying about that gives the PUC authority to make some exceptions based on standards in the law.
Okay, members, so you'll have copies of that shortly, so we'll be able to do that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, that's all I was asking, and if we have copies, that would be great, just so we know what the whole bill really does.
Mr. Chair, and if I could just go through what does not do.
Senator Rosen.
It does not repeal the 25x25 renewable energy standards. It does not modify the SIP program or their Minnesota conservation goals. It does not modify the low-income conservation assistance, and this is all in the Next Gen Act. It does not modify the utilities recovery of infrastructure costs or the state government energy savings plan. It does not modify seabed or the renewable energy investment cost recovery or the wind energy curtailment payments. And it does not do anything with our renewable energy standards. All it does is allow utilities to include new coal generated power as an option to meet the Minnesota power demands, subject to all the requirements that any power source needs for approval at the PUC. And this includes a certificate of need and all environmental regulations we have in state and federal statutes. So that's basically what it is.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask Mr. Olson a question, too, if I may. Thank you. And Mr. Olson, I appreciate your testimony, and you've really laid out the arguments in support of a new coal plant. I guess I'd like to know, does your company have a position on climate change, on support? Does your company support any national legislation on climate change? Is that something that's of concern to your, or carbon emissions a concern to your company in general? Do you have a policy on that?
Mr. Olson.
Senator Anderson, our company doesn't have a policy other than our position is that with respect to federal legislation, we believe that any such legislation shouldn't disadvantage utilities and states like Minnesota that have a high reliance on coal.
And, Mr. Chair, if I can answer a little of that, too.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. The industry, the coal industry, has done a tremendous amount of work in the last 30 years on their emissions, and they're continuing to work on that. And I think, with all due respect, they have they should be part of our energy profile. I mean, even the President of the United States mentioned nuclear and clean coal in his State of the Union address. And so this is something that will continue to always meet the federal and state guidelines. And it still has the proper ruling, but I think it should be part of our energy portfolio.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. I guess I have a question. And, you know, Mr. Olson, as I travel to a lot of conferences on energy around the country, and I've actually heard James Hansen and Stephen Chu speak about coal as being part of our energy future, that we have so many hundreds of years of coal available, and that we are the cleanest in the world at burning coal, and actually the cleanest in the world at creating any source of energy. But you mentioned having to buy offsets. And when I try to research these offset markets, it doesn't seem like there's any tangible way that there's actually an offset. It seems like more like a sin tax for producing CO2 that, quite honestly, and members, when you want to get into it today, I have my stack of evidence on CO2 and things here as not being harmful. Published and peer-reviewed data, by the way. So I'm ready to go there if you want to enter that. But it seems like a sin tax, and I can't find any connection to an actual helping of reducing CO2. Can you know, maybe as someone in the industry, you could tell me what the industry knows about buying these offsets? Is there a direct connection? Are they actually offsetting something somewhere, or are we just shipping our money again from Minnesota or the upper Midwest to some other market?
Mr. Chair, I would say the latter. The statutory provision in the Next Gen Act that Senate File 86 seeks to repeal allows a couple of ways of offsetting. One is with reductions in CO2 emissions from other facilities, and that's what we're arguing about in front of the Minnesota PUC, and that does have a direct reduction. With respect to purchase of CO2 allowances on one of the exchanges, I don't see any CO2 benefit with respect to purchasing those. It's just money out of the pockets of Minnesota consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, just one other quick, I guess it's a question. I just want to be clear that this... Mr. Olson, you said we have about 60% of our electricity needs are met by coal in Minnesota, I think that's what you said. And I just want to be clear that this bill, the law as it stands now, does not reduce the amount of coal power that would be produced in Minnesota. It doesn't do anything to affect existing coal plants, correct? And this would only, the law doesn't allow new coal plants to be added in beyond the 60%. Is that your understanding?
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, your understanding is correct. The existing statute does not have a direct impact on existing plants.
So I guess, Mr. Olson, that would beg the question then, if it doesn't have an impact on existing plants, so there's the way our language is, it's so arbitrary that you couldn't literally build a new plant and then decommission an existing plant without knowing that that was a direct offset? Is that what I'm understanding, that it's there's no way to interpret that today?
Mr. Chair, I am not sure as I sit here if a company built a new coal-fired power plant and simultaneously decommissioned an old coal-fired power plant that would classify as an offset under the existing statutory language.
Thank you. All right, if there's no further questions. Okay, Senator Tibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to get your attention for a little bit here.
Oh, sorry.
Just to the earlier point that you made about these offsets and what are they and are they hocus pocus and occurring in other places, you know, the language is pretty clear in the bill, both in the repealer language on page 2, you know, starting in paragraph C there, line 13. Offsets need to be permanent, quantifiable, verifiable, enforceable, and would not have otherwise occurred. And that, of course, is in 216H.02, that same language we find. So it's not like we're buying some make-believe trees in Africa or something. I mean, that has been a concern. Or, you know, someone put it at one point, or what is an offset? Is it a prize in a Cracker Jack box? You know, that's why that language is fairly specific. And, I think there was a shared concern about that. What is an offset, and is it really offsetting anything.
Well, Senator Dibble, I guess I'm not reading the same thing in the bill, because it talks about producing verifiable emission reductions. However, when you buy an offset in the market, I can't find verifiable reductions, and that's what I'm speaking to, and I think that's what Mr. Olson was speaking to. So whether we can control that in the state, that's another reason to repeal this, is we can't control those kind of issues in other states. Senator Rosen, you had an answer to that as well.
Yes, thank you. And I would like to address the offsets, which basically a coal plant can be built if the utility offsets carbon, an existing plant, or it purchases the allowances. And right now, when we did pass it in 07, as I mentioned, we expected a cap and trade system in place, and that hasn't come to fruition. There's the regional greenhouse gas initiatives is based in the Northeast and in California, and some of the Western states and Canadian provinces are in the process of establishing another system, but that it still hasn't come to market. And so these allowances are extremely expensive, and we're just sending a lot of capital out of the state, and it's going to become very prohibitive just to meet that offset. If that answers your question, Senator Dibble.
Senator Dibble?
Well, it's a slightly different subject, Mr. Chair, but I'd also argue that we are sending a lot of money out of state by pursuing a coal energy policy. I mean, that's a fact, and we have an opportunity to develop a lot of our economic interests locally, by pursuing other sorts of energy options. So, I mean, shipping money out of state, 60%, that's one thing that's kind of remarkable about Minnesota, is how much of our energy dollar we're exporting already. This is arguably a way to keep those dollars and do that generation and benefit our local economy through the SIP and through, through a renewable power policy. But, Mr. Chair, I had another inquiry.
Go ahead, Senator Dibble.
In response to Senator Anderson's question about whether or not Great River Energy supported a national carbon policy of any sort, your answer was we are against anything that disadvantages coal generation in Minnesota or something like that. We are familiar, we know, of course, that at the national level, I mean, we hear this all the time in Minnesota whenever on any matter of regulation or even consumer protection, we get folks in from industry who say, well, there should only be federal legislation. We shouldn't do something that's unique and specific to Minnesota. Meanwhile, that very company, or as a part of its trade association, is fighting any efforts to make any progress at the federal level. So that specifically is my question. Is Great River Energy participating in efforts through the courts to stop any progress on addressing carbon dioxide emissions, or politically through legislation stopping the Environmental Protection Agency from addressing and managing and regulating carbon dioxide emissions, or through its political program in putting policymakers in place that are trying to quash any efforts to address carbon dioxide emissions at the federal level?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Olson.
And Senator Dibble. Answer one of your questions. There were several in there. Great River Energy is not participating in any of the lawsuits with respect to federal regulation of greenhouse gases at this time. With respect to our political effort, we're actually right now involved directly with our National Trade Association, the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, with working on a proposal that would create some certainty with respect to the operation of coal plants and the cleaning them up in the future, to try to work cooperatively and proactively on something that we think makes sense. So we're actually taking affirmative action to try to solve some of the issues.
So,
Senator DiBello, just
final question.
Trying to remind you to kind of stay on the bill, and we're getting a little afield of the bill.
We are not getting afield of the bill, Mr. Chair.
I think you are.
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I appreciate your commentary. We're talking about clean coal as being virtuous, and our president, God love him, and our energy secretary, God love him, is running around talking about clean coal. How close are we to having clean coal? I mean, I know we've done a lot to deal with NOx and SOx and particulates and mercury. What about greenhouse gas emissions? I mean, how close are we? Is that realistic or isn't it? I hear a lot about it and never seems to be in the near term. It seems to always be kind of a little beyond the horizon.
And perhaps Mr. Olson wants to address this, but I believe one of the cleanest coal plants that will be coming online is out of Spiritwood, North Dakota, that uses a combination. You're doing the malting plant with the energy. I mean, it's just a great combination. And I should really let him explain it better, but that is about ready to come online as of January 1st. Is that correct? And so every year with this industry that's been in place for a long time, the EPA follows it very closely, the scrubbers that are put on, the carbon sequestration, all the new technologies that are in place. So it is a constantly an evolving technology and industry. And I think instead of penalizing it, we should be embracing it because they are always getting better. And it is part of the portfolio that we have, the big scheme that we have to look at.
And it is interesting, members, when, you know, I am a statistical nut, so I'm always looking at what kind of things we're doing. We are the cleanest country on the face of the earth. We, our water, our air, everything gets cleaner. And if you actually study EPA statistics on air quality, we have cities today that are cleaner with people in them than they ever were when they had ambient air, when they were still rural folks that EPA has tested. So, and much of our CO2 and mercury is transient. We have all that documentation. So we really need to think about those things as we're putting more and more restrictions on the things that are in the United States. So Senator Stumpf, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Olson, do you have any idea how much investment dollars have gone into the plants, the coal plants, and you know, in the last number of years? I mean, I've heard that it's a lot of investment that has gone into it, and consequently, it has been part of the reason why the energy costs have gone up in the last few years.
Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, there has been billions of dollars across the country in investments to make coal plants cleaner. I'm not the expert to talk about that. I know one of the other witnesses has a fair amount of testimony on that very subject.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. That's, I'm hoping we can move on, members, so we do get all our testifiers in. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, just one more question. Mr. Olson, do you know, I believe that the Spiritwood plant was, I don't know exactly where it was in the process, but it was being started or planned or contemplated or when this bill was passed in 2007, and there's some exemptions in here for other facilities that were already in the process of being planned or built. And do you know why your company didn't ask for an exemption under the law in 2007?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Olson.
Senator Anderson, as I indicated in my testimony, we believed that we had some offsets that would work under the statute.
And, Mr. Chair, I presume you still believe that since you're litigating that, but we don't know the answer.
Mr. Olson.
That's correct, Senator.
Thank you. Our next witness is Dr. Michael Jones. Welcome, Dr. Jones, if you would introduce yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm your neighbor to the west from North Dakota, and I appreciate the opportunity to come here and share some thoughts on the deliberations in front of the committee today. My name is Dr. Mike Jones, and I hold the position of Vice President of Research and Development for the Lignite Energy Council and serve as Director and Technical Representative for the State of North Dakota's Lignite Research Development and Marketing Program. My PhD is in physics from the University of North Dakota, and I work for about 30 years with the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota, focused on research and development of clean and efficient energy technology systems so Upper Midwest residents and businesses can use the abundant coal resources of our state and the country. The Lignite Energy Council is a regional trade association representing lignite producers who sell about 30 million tons of lignite annually, utilities which generate affordable, reliable electricity for 2 million people in our region, and businesses that provide the goods and services accounting for nearly $3 billion in gross business volume. As you all know, an ample supply of affordable energy is crucial to the economic growth of any state. North Dakota's lignite industry provides electricity to customers in more than two-thirds of Minnesota. Much of this territory is served by rural and suburban electric distribution cooperatives and municipal utilities. It is important to note that North Dakota delivers low-cost, reliable electricity from lignite, and we also do it in a manner which is compatible with federal environmental standards. The owners of the power plants, which also invested approximately $1.7 billion in emission control technologies to reduce pollutants regulated by the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. Of that, about $1 billion has been spent in just the last 2 years. The result of that, North Dakota is one of only 12 states in the nation, along with Minnesota, that meets all of the federal ambient air quality standards. We also consistently receive an A grade from the American Lung Association for our air quality. The state of North Dakota is an active financial partner with the lignite industry in research and development projects to further reduce emissions and improve efficiencies. The money invested by the state comes from a tax collected on every ton of lignite mined. Since 1987, the state of North Dakota has invested more than $60 million in 150-plus lignite research and development projects with a total value of more than $570 million. Currently, the state has leveraged $8 million in support of about $180 million worth of projects to advance technologies to capture and store carbon dioxide from the power plants. And, Mr. Chairman, I do have a listing of those projects I'd be happy to share with the committee, if that's of interest to the group.
Thank you, Mr. Jones.
I'd be interested.
We'll get that passed out.
The largest R&D project is called the Plain CO2 Reduction Partnership, or PCOR. It is partially funded by the U.S. Department of Energy. This is one of seven regional partnerships established by the Department of Energy, really focused on trying to understand the challenges within regions of capture and sequestration of CO2. Many of the Lignite Energy Council members, along with the state of North Dakota, are involved with PCOR, which is identifying, quantifying, and determining the technical feasibility and economic costs of various CO2 storage technologies in our region, which includes nine Midwestern states and three Canadian provinces. North Dakota is also home to the world's largest carbon capture project. The Great Plains Synfuels plant uses gasification technology to make synthetic natural gas from lignite. Approximately 8,500 tons of CO2 per day are captured and sold to the Canadian oil firm. The gas is used for enhanced oil recovery in partially depleted oil fields near Weyburn, Saskatchewan. While that technology is significantly different, since it is a synfuels plant, than what you would find at a power plant, the existing infrastructure can be used to move CO2 once it becomes economically captured from the power plants. In addition, a $80,000 investment by the state has resulted in the sale of almost all the fly ash produced by Great River's Coal Creek Station. What once was a waste product is now sold as a replacement for Portland cement in making a very durable concrete. In fact, fly ash from this plant was used in rebuilding the I-35W bridge. This resulted in a savings of 1 ton of CO2 for every ton of Portland cement replaced with fly ash. The benefits to Minnesota from regional lignite industry include access to low-cost, reliable electricity. That's good for job creation in all corners of the state. There are also more than 70 Minnesota companies that provide direct goods and services to the mines and plants. Some provide the labor required for scheduled outages to clean boilers, rewire turbines, and paint the exteriors of equipment and plants. Others provide materials such as conveyors, instrumentation, and fire protection systems. Often these companies sell the same products and services to Minnesota utilities or Minnesota mining companies, resulting in more economic regional activity. We believe the energy partnership between the lignite industry and the state of Minnesota has been mutually rewarding. It makes sense for Minnesota to continue this energy partnership that not only meets the customer's needs, but allows your state to be among the industry leaders in investing, researching, and developing better technologies that result in reduced emissions, increased efficiencies, and the power needed to build a stronger Minnesota economy. On behalf of the members of the Lignite Energy Council, we encourage you to pass this legislation and continue this energy partnership between our states. I thank you for your time and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Jones, and thank you for the handout. It's very informative on the projects that are in process. Questions, members? Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a curious question. We had the other day, we had the opportunity to go through the, I believe they call it the MISO distribution MISO area. It was very interesting, and it had the, up on this board, it was like a huge computer, but it had the prices of all the different electric rates, and it seemed, as far as I could see, that the lowest price electric electricity was actually was the coal-fired electricity. Now, is that true or,
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Jones,
Senator, that is true. The electricity which is produced from North Dakota lignite is among the lowest costs that you'll find in the region and the, throughout the country.
Anything else? All right, thank you, Mr. Jones. Next up is Bride Seifert and Carl Crimmins. I don't know, maybe we can pull another chair up to the table so we can. We're running just a little behind on testimony here, so we want to make sure we're concise. So thanks. Welcome and introduce yourselves for the tape.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Bride Seifert. I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here today asking your support for Senate File 86. As you know, the Chamber has over 2,300 members in the state of Minnesota, representing over a half a million employees. All of those business folks are concerned with competitive, reliable electricity. Part of the reason here in Minnesota that we've enjoyed competitively priced electricity is because the vast majority of our base load comes from two sources, and that's coal and nuclear. We've got a moratorium on nuclear, and we've got a virtual moratorium on coal power. Now, there's been a huge push for conservation and energy efficiency, and we absolutely support that. The need to avoid that generation is the best steps we can take. But we just don't think that's always going to be the case in the future. We've also got a leading renewable energy standard. And as of now, our utilities are perfectly on track to meet that. But if you take our energy policy as a whole, it's simply too restrictive. We've gotten to the point where instead of utilities being able to explore all of their options and coming up with the best solution, they're stuck looking solely to renewables or gas. And that doesn't give us the best option for planning for the future. It's one thing to shape policy, and it's another thing to shackle it. That's where we stand now, with minimal options that might up seriously compromising our competitiveness and our reliability in the years to come. That's why we're here asking for your support for this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Crimmins?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is Carl Crimmins. I'm the president of the Minnesota Pipe Trades Association in Minnesota, and I want to bring from the president of the State Building and Construction Council, Harry Melander. He had a conflict. He couldn't make it here tonight, today, so I wanted to say hello for him. But the pipe trades and other construction trades are currently experiencing over twice the national average of unemployment. We support Senate File 86, first, for the job potential, and second, to ensure a comprehensive energy policy that includes all type of energy for the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? If not, our next two testifiers are Bill Galan and Jeff Nielsen. By themselves, yes. They can just getting them in the queue. I want to make sure we have everybody in the queue, so we stay on time. Welcome, Mr. Galan.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Bill Galan. I live in Edina, Minnesota. I'm still unemployed, and I'm here as a private citizen. Didn't bring any proof, though, Mr. Fuller. I just wanted to make three very quick points here that you'll, in either later this afternoon or on Tuesday, will hear a number of talking points in opposition to Senate File 86. I sit here in favor of the passage of Senate File 86, and I'll give a couple of reasons as they go along. But one, you'll hear some earnest discussion of a model that we use at the state government to do resource planning, a computer model, and how that produces the result that wind power is the cheapest resource. Well, I did a little research on my own at the U.S. Department of Energy's Energy Information Administration's website, their 2011 Annual Energy Outlook, and just looking at their estimates, the federal government's estimates of the cost of new generation resources, unlike existing ones we had the discussion with Senator Stumpf a few moments ago, but going forward, what is the cost to put new resources in the ground? And according to the Department of Energy, conventional coal, these are levelized costs, levelized over the life of the plant, $94.80. New wind, $97. So it shows at least another computer model where we have coal as being a lower cost resource than wind. And solar PV, for those of you who are interested, $210, so more than twice as expensive as conventional coal or wind power. But I'm not asking you to believe this model or that model. What I'm asking is let's give utilities and power plant developers a chance to come in and make the case. I've appeared in front of the Public Utilities Commission under various hats for the last 16, 17 years, and I have a great deal of confidence in them as an institution that they'll make the right decision for Minnesota ratepayers. They will not allow a facility into rate base or be granted a certificate of need or any of the other permits necessary if it's going to bankrupt the utility or its ratepayers. Let a utility come in and make the case, and maybe they won't be able to. Maybe that once we do a thorough analysis of a specific proposal, that we'll come to the conclusion that it's not viable. But from my reading of the statute, that's really not permissible at this time. So a couple of other points that you'll hear. One, that no utility in Minnesota is proposing to build a new baseload plant before 2024, 2025, whatever the date is, or no coal plant. I'm not exactly sure what the talking point read. But notwithstanding the existence of Mr. Olson and his power plant, this idea that nobody needs new baseload or nobody needs any such resources. About a year ago, and I sent this letter to the committee, the former version of this committee, where I had a career staff person go through every resource plan then on file. Granted, it was a year ago, then on file at the Public Utilities Commission to see, well, what kind of resources are utilities actually saying that we need? And, you know, the Big Stone 2 plant was on the list, and the Sutherland 4 plant from Iowa was on the list. They've since been canceled, but we have Basin Electric, 400 megawatts, not specified, 2014. Darylin Power, 50 megawatts of baseload, 2013. MMPA, 50 megawatts of baseload, 2016. Minn Kota Power, 150 megawatts of baseload, date unknown. I'm not sure when they had planned to build that. And it may well be the case that the economic situation has changed, that utilities, we've heard the GRE has rethought their baseload needs going forward. Or it could be that utilities have gotten the message, since we prohibit nuclear, we prohibit coal, just don't bother coming forward with a baseload resource. But I would caution, you know, we can work on policy, but it doesn't change the underlying physics or the underlying economics of the industry just because we have a set of policy preferences that we express in statute. And the third point that I'd like to make quickly here this afternoon, I find amazing that many of the folks who trumpeted the coal ban being included in the Next Gen Energy Act as a singular triumph, some of those same individuals are now finding newfound flexibility in the statute to allow new facilities to be built. And I have to say, as the person or one of the folks who was responsible for enforcing this law for 2.5 years, I would challenge anybody to say they've read that and reread that statute more times than I have. And I cannot tell you, sitting here this afternoon, what kind of facilities are allowed or not allowed. And so we had a discussion, would a new coal plant on an existing coal plant site be, I couldn't give anybody any reassurance that they could rebuild an existing site. And I just wanted to read to you from a letter that former Governor Pawlenty sent to the legislature back in May of 2007 before the bill was passed, where he specifically asked the legislature not to include the coal ban as part of the Next Gen Energy Act. And he wrote, this language threatens the reliability and cost competitiveness of the state's energy supply by placing a moratorium on nearly all major new transmission lines and generating facilities. I think those words were true in 2007, and I could not in all assurance give assurances to somebody proposing a new transmission line that might possibly carry coal power from another state, or somebody building a gas plant or other large energy facility that they have safe harbor under this law. And perhaps the Public Utilities Commission will develop that over the years, but in the absence of that, I would encourage this committee and the Senate to pass Senate File 86. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Glahn. I have a question. As we look at some of this legislation, it occurs to me that, you know, over time, legislators tend to dictate the winners and losers, and that seems like exactly what this kind of a moratorium, if you will, a virtual moratorium. We'll use that term because it seems to really fit. But you spoke about, you know, being somebody that deals with or has dealt in the past with the PUC and being around these issues for many, many years, that the PUC has enough criteria to work off of to determine if and when the plants are necessary, if they're the right cost for the consumers. I guess I'm thinking, do you believe if we, and you said you're in favor of this, but does taking out the legislative dictates, do you think the PUC has enough tools to make those kind of proper decisions, both on the environmental front and on the cost front?
Mr. Chair, I believe they do, that if you were to today pass this legislation and the governor were to sign it, the commission has broad authority to protect ratepayers. The prudency tests that are written into statute would prohibit facilities that aren't needed or are not cost-effective from being built. And there's lots of regulations regarding protecting the environment that's not just under the PUC but under the PCA and other agencies. So I would feel very comfortable with protections for the environment and for ratepayers in the existing statute and existing case law.
Thank you. Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Glahn, I just have to ask, if this law was so bad and Governor Pawlenty wrote this letter saying how bad it was, why on earth did he sign this into law? Do you have any idea?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, actually I thought Senator Rosen gave a very good answer to that in her introductory remarks, that there are lots of good things that were in the Next Gen Energy Act. And here we are 4 years downrange taking a look at, okay, now that we have a few years under our belt in implementing the law, what's working, what's not working. So we have the instance of this this section of statute did not take effect until August of 2009, if I remember correctly, because all of the things that we expected to happen didn't happen. So we passed the statute back in 2007 with a view of how the future would unfold and a whole bunch of premises and assumptions underlying the language and the structure of the statute, which have not come to pass and frankly don't seem to be in the cards anytime in the near future. So we have a much different landscape than we thought we were going to have in 2007, and I think now is an appropriate time to rethink a few of these issues.
And
Senator Rosen?
And also to that, Midwestern Governors Association that the governor was a part of has shifted away from that initiative of lowering the greenhouse gases to a more long-term initiative aimed at positioning the Midwest for investments of all kinds, and that's quote-unquote, that's their goal. And in fact, many of those governors are not in place anymore.
I believe none of those governors
none of those governors
anymore.
Are in place.
And Senator Anderson, I'd like to clearly say as a person that did support most of what was in that, many times as legislators, a lot of the public doesn't understand that if 80% of the bill is good, we typically will vote in favor of it, even if we have to hold our nose on that 20%. And quite honestly, that's what I had to do on this mm-hmm. particular bill. But there was a lot of good things in the bill that I did agree with. So we can hate this portion and have loved a bunch of other portions. All right, anything else? Thank you, Mr. Glahn. Jeff Nielsen. Welcome, Mr. Nielsen. Please identify yourself for the tape.
Good afternoon. I'm Jeff Nielsen. I'm General Manager of United Farmers Cooperatives in Winthrop, Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the rest of the committee for the opportunity to be here. Senator Rosen did a nice job of giving us a little plug today. I feel a little bit of pressure as I have 100 of my peers here today representing the Cooperative Association, and I had the opportunity to present the testimony. Minnesota Cooperative Network is an association of many cooperatives, and Minnesota prides itself on being the land of 10,000 lakes, but we have nearly 1,000 cooperatives. You might be surprised of all we're involved in, from farm supply and grain, electric transmission, credit unions, healthcare, dairy, grocery stores, transportation, farm credit. In fact, I believe the number is something like there's 3.5 million Minnesotans who are members of co-ops, and I think that's probably nearly half the population of the state. I'm a general manager. I'm not really good at math. There's a lot of co-ops where you get to know them. My job here is to represent the consumers and talk a little bit from our perspective and why we're in support of Senate File 86. Cooperatives are a different business model, and we live in a day and age today where there's a lot of scrutiny, if you will, about business practices. But cooperatives are truly grassroots. I report to a board, as do any of the cooperatives, and so there's a lot of accountability. And so part of my purpose here is to talk about what we see in the importance of continuing to explore all options of power. Cooperatives in our state, in fact, contribute about $18 billion in economic activity. We provide about 80,000 jobs and pay about $150 million in taxes. And so we appreciate the hard work that goes on as you look at these budgets. A little bit about my co-op to give you some perspective of where I'm coming from. I manage a farm supply and grain cooperative. Our headquarters are in Winthrop, Minnesota. It's about 70 miles southwest of here. Well, today we do about $200 million in sales. We employ about 200 people across about a dozen communities. Our main purpose is we serve rural residents and farmers with everything from their fertilizer inputs, chemicals, seed, heating fuels, things such as that. We're in several communities. As I said, we're a consumer-owned, and we're owned by our members that we serve. We've enjoyed working with Senator Rosen over the years. She obviously knows her business living in Minnesota. We hope that by repealing this, that it'll ensure the reliability of power, because we need that to continue with our businesses that we're involved in every day. I think the entire co-op community, like I said, my 100 folks that are gathered around, we support this. We know it's not perfect. I'd also like to share, there's been a lot of talk about base load, and there's a lot more people that are more capable of speaking to that than I, so I'll maybe stay away from that. But I would like to just share from, because I do have some experience with alternative energy sources, renewable fuels. We've been involved, and our members have been involved in ethanol production since 1995. I believe the Heartland Corn Ethanol Plant in Winthrop was one of the first ones to come online. It's grown. It's widely recognized as one of the best in the industry and in the country for that matter, and it's farmer-owned. So there's a lot of accountability there. Not many of you have to provide a scorecard, you folks do, but businesses that, you know, it's open books. So we have an accountability that I think is really, really good. We also are involved through some of our associations in wind power. Both are very good alternatives, and we need to keep working hard at those. But in the meantime, we have to run our businesses, and we have to feed an ever-growing population. I've been involved in that my entire life, growing up on a dairy farm and basically working for cooperatives since then. Last year alone, our little company spent about a little over $2.2 million for electricity, fuel, and gas to deliver the products, condition grain, and deliver those things to market. Of that, about 650,000 of it was electricity. It takes a lot of electricity. Our concern is we have to have some balance, and I think by this repealing this, it allows us to continue to use coal, which we believe is safe. People are working hard to make it safer. At the same time, provide some encouragement. I believe the number is like 25% of our load is already coming from alternative sources. Again, there's other experts here better at that than I. But at the end, I guess we believe this legislation would help us provide a positive economic force in our territory. This legislation would also help lessen the economic burden on consumers in our area. That's important, obviously, today more than ever. And they'd likely have to pay a premium for baseload power if we don't look at this and try to find some balance. So in closing, I'd like to thank you for your time in authoring this legislation. I encourage the entire committee to join the chair in support of this so that we can find that balance and keep moving forward in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Nielsen. I think you were key in kind of explaining how a lot of people feel. Just because we believe in repealing this virtual moratorium, again, I'll use that term because that's the way it is, doesn't mean we don't believe in innovation, doesn't mean we don't want to move forward with alternative energy sources. And I think some people, you know, paint us into the corner on things like that. So you made that statement very eloquently. So I appreciate that a lot. Any question, members? All right.
Thank you.
Just for planning purposes, members, it looks like time-wise, we want to give the opponents plenty of time, so it looks like we'll probably cut this off today after the Office of Energy Security and come back Tuesday for the opponents, if that's going to work out. So, we want to make sure everybody gets time so we get a full discussion on everything. So, Bill Grant and Kate O'Connell next. And I don't really have to say, well, welcome, but I don't really have to say, say your name for the tapes. I'm sure you guys, some of you know the drill well, and
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security. And I have with me this afternoon Kate O'Connell, who is our manager of energy planning and advocacy. And what we'd like to cover Senate File 86 are the issues of need, cost, and job creation. I'd like to start by reminding you that the Next Generation Energy Act enjoyed broad bipartisan support. I believe it passed the Senate virtually unanimously. Governor Pawlenty signed the measure, setting in motion a number of things, including the work of the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group and the Minnesota and the Midwest Governors Association's Greenhouse Gas Reduction Accord, which he and Governor Doyle of Wisconsin were instrumental in spearheading. Minnesota Statute 216-H03, which Senate File 86 would repeal, was really the linchpin to achieving final agreement among bill conferees. And the reason for that is quite clear. A lot has been said this afternoon already about the other aspects of the Next Generation Energy Act that move us forward on alternative and clean energy, energy efficiency, and so forth. But what bill authors understood, what conferees understood at that time, was that if we weren't going to take one step forward and two steps backwards with respect to reducing our reliance on coal, but also reducing our contributions to climate change, that we were going to need to prevent backsliding, and we were going to need to avoid investments that would result in backsliding. And even if we are to completely exercise our options and our opportunities with respect to efficiency and renewables, I think it's pretty clear that one large new coal-fired facility can net us out in a negative direction with respect to our global warming emissions. And for those reasons, this was really the linchpin of the Next Generation Energy Act. And by passing this bill, you would undo that very delicately crafted agreement. I want to make it clear that, from our view, Senate File 86 is not needed because, and this issue has already come up, Minnesota's utilities have provided us their integrated resource plans, and they show no need for new baseload capacity other than what's already in the pipeline through 2024. And I want to be clear about this because there are baseload and other energy resource acquisition activities underway, including uprates of nuclear power plants in Minnesota. We've invested in new hydro contracts with Canada, and we're investing in a combination of gas, wind, and energy efficiency, which, from a systems planner perspective, can all often look like and mimic baseload energy supply. In fact, gas, wind, and energy efficiency in combination is less expensive than, has shorter construction lead times and permitting lead times, and more modular operations than new coal, and are certainly, in combination, less controversial than building new coal plants. New coal is also too expensive. It's really not surprising that no Minnesota utilities are proposing to build new coal. The Spiritwood plant, of course, was planned and in permitting when the Next Generation Energy Act was proposed. But this is a trend that's occurring nationally. We're seeing coal plants canceled. The Big Stone plant was mentioned. The plant in Iowa was mentioned. This is happening across the country, not because we just don't like coal, but because investors have found that coal investments are too risky and are shedding their investments in projects like this left and right. And certainly part of that is the decline in energy demand as a result of the recession. But really, if it were only a demand-supply equation, I don't think we'd be looking at the mass cancellations that we've seen of new coal plants that we have seen. It's the fact that coal is risky from a number of perspectives. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. And this is driving investors away from projects like this, as they did ultimately with the Big Stone plant. New coal, like that proposed by the Excelsior Energy Project, an integrated gasification combined cycle plant, which is a new technology, would be projected to cost $3.5 billion for a new 1,000-megawatt plant. Compare that to the cost of a new gas combined cycle plant at around $1 billion. Energy efficiency at less than or around 2 cents a kilowatt hour. We have better options, and particularly at a time when we're not seeing a lot of load growth, there's no urgency about repealing this section of the Next Generation Energy Act. It's been discussion about the exemptions that were created by the act, and I want to be clear about this because I don't think that it's fair to refer to this as a virtual moratorium. The word I use is restrictions on construction of new coal, and there are, in fact, I think it's only because we really haven't had new coal plants to test the statute that we really haven't heard a lot about the possibilities provided by the statute. Those plants primarily fueled by natural gas would be allowed. Plants that inject carbon dioxide emissions underground to prevent their emissions would, to the extent that that's occurring, would not be prohibited by the statute. And then we've had the discussion about offsets, and I'll have a more on that in a moment. And then plants that are either built in Minnesota or outside of Minnesota and imported into the state can be approved as long as the Public Utilities Commission finds those plants essential. And I think it's clear that current law requires a proposer of a new coal plant to meet nearly the same standard. In other words, you have to receive a certificate of need demonstrating need for a new facility. And the essential standard, I think, is the rough equivalent of what a new coal plant would have to accomplish under the existing statute. We've had some discussion this afternoon about the Spiritwood project, and that issue, as members know, is now pending resolution at the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, who have referred a particular aspect of their interpretation of the statute to an administrative law judge to clarify the statute and help develop a factual record for the commission. The Next Generation Energy Act made it clear that an imported coal plant importing electricity into Minnesota could go forward as long as they provided qualifying offsets. Now, that could include projects undertaken on that utility system to reduce CO2 emissions. It wouldn't have to be at the power plant. But it could also be swapping out an old coal plant for a new coal plant. And I think even though that language hasn't been tested, Mr. Chairman, because no one has proposed such an offset, I think it's fairly clear that if there were no net emissions of CO2 in the deal, that a project such as that could go forward. So we're on a track now to resolve that issue in front of the commission. It is the most contentious part of the statute. I think it would be prudent before we rush to repeal a statute that really hasn't been interpreted yet and therefore not fully implemented, that we allow that process to conclude. And certainly it will, in plenty of time for this body to consider this by this time next year. And, Mr. Chairman, I think I can say with some certainty that we won't have any new coal plant proposals coming before us between now and then. With Mr. that, Grant, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. O'Connell, unless there are questions for me.
I have a question for you. So, and I've basically had this question for everyone in this committee and in this building that, you know, it's my ninth year here, and you mentioned that in doing 216H03, that was kind of the linchpin in the conference committee, but you talked about climate change contributions and global warming emissions. As you know, I've studied this issue in great detail. Maybe you're the guy that can finally provide me some evidence, because for 8 years I've asked for somebody to show me some evidence that CO2 or greenhouse gas emissions have any relationship to climate changes or temperature changes or anything. I'm looking forward to that science. I've offered to other people that I would stand on the quadriga at the top of the Capitol and scream I was wrong if anybody could provide that documentation. But I've spent 8 years of my life studying 13 different disciplines of science. In even tropospherical chemistry class, they said with certainty that there was no piece of scientific research that linked CO2 with any kind of temperature change, and that there was only one piece of evidence that was done in a laboratory under controlled circumstances that would even say that CO2 has the ability to enhance the greenhouse effect. So I've studied four different iterations of IPCC reports. I brought some of those here as well in case anybody wanted to reference them, and studied all the science that has been presented in those reports. And I'm just really having a hard time when people use those kind of terminologies when we're talking here, because nobody's given me any piece of evidence. And I love to study the science. I have a background in biochemistry. And I can find all this that will refute anything that CO2 has any relationship, and yet nothing that shows a relationship. So are you the guy that can provide me that documentation?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I am not a scientist. And so the answer, strictly speaking, is no. I rely on the work of the National Academy of Sciences, which is really the collective body of scientists that have studied this issue here in this country to provide me with their findings in terms of what the science is telling us about climate change. There's one piece of evidence, though, that I will cite that is most compelling to me, and that is the graph of historic temperature record with CO2 levels in the atmosphere. They are in lockstep together, and that goes back not just as long as we've been recording surface temperatures on the Earth. This is ice core data that goes back millennia, and it's clear as CO2 levels rise and fall in the atmosphere, so too does temperature, again, in virtual lockstep. And the current temperature record, and pairing that, again, with CO2 levels in the atmosphere, shows an alarming trend in a very upward direction of both temperature and greenhouse effect.
Well, Mr. Grant, I'd love to discuss that, and I do have those charts here, and I can tell you that CO2 lags on average 20 years behind the temperature, that it is a positive feedback issue, that when the temperature goes up, we actually release CO2 from the oceans and other issues. So I'd be happy to go over that with you, but it does have a lockstep in terms of looking at the Vostok ice cores and things, which I've done a great deal of study on. So be happy to discuss that later, but it's temperature goes up first, CO2 follows it. It's a positive feedback effect and very explainable in terms of science. So thank you, but I'm hoping that somebody in the audience on the opposite side can bring in that data on Tuesday or meet me before that and convince me, because I am most open-minded on the subject of science, and I want to take care of our environment any way we can, so I thank you for that. Senator Benson.
Mr. Grant, Mr. Chair, you mentioned that both Iowa and North Dakota had power plant projects that were shut down, were stopped, because investors find it too risky and because it's not really viable economically. So what is the harm in us removing this from statute if investors are already saying, oh, don't worry about it, we get it, no big deal? Because if we're really worried about carbon plants or coal plants pumping carbon into the atmosphere and investors are saying, no, we're not going to do it anyway, then there really is no risk if that's the case. Do Iowa and North Dakota have statutes like this that shut down the plant, or was it the economics?
Mr. Grant.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Benson, to my knowledge, and it was South Dakota and Iowa, neither of those states have laws in place like Minnesota does. I think it's important to remember that the reasoning behind this provision in the statute, remember that it was linked to adoption of a greenhouse gas regulatory regime, and the thinking was, and I believe still is, or should be, that by having these sorts of restrictions in place, it creates pressure on federal regulators, where this problem really resides, to resolve what kind of regulatory environment we're going to enter into going forward. And that by placing these restrictions into statute, we help hold feet to the fire to make sure that we're moving in that direction. And the fact that we haven't done so yet, to me, is not a reason to repeal the statute, all the more reason to leave it in place.
Senator Rosen, you wanted to answer that a little bit too as well.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Benson. As we mentioned several times, some of the things that had to come into place for this to all work have not occurred. So that's why this is problematic and needs to be revisited, because we aren't going to have a cap-and-trade program, a federal cap-and-trade program. And the carbon dioxide allowances are very difficult to get, and they're very expensive. And those are the two main factors. The other thing that I would like to comment on Director Grant's comments is that there is no urgency to this bill, and I'd like to differ on that, because North Dakota is very serious about challenging the constitutionality of this prohibition on purchasing their power or any power from any other state. So
we have to be very cognizant. It's out. They've put away $500,000 to file a lawsuit against Minnesota, which should be, and they are very serious about dropping that lawsuit by the end of the month or the 1st of April. So I don't think Minnesota really wants to get in that challenge. I don't think, number one, we could afford it. And then number two, I think we will lose because we have not, the workings of this bill have not come into place. So they have very good grounds to stand on. And I have talked many, many times with the Attorney General from Attorney General Stengem from North Dakota, the greatest guy in the whole world, and he's very serious about this.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I believe Ms. O'Connell had a response for Senator Benson as well.
Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you. Chairman, Senator Benson, that is a good question. What difference does it make? And what I can tell you is that both Otter Tail Power and Interstate Power and Light got certificates to build those plants. Otter Tail got a certificate from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. IPL got a certificate from the Iowa Utilities Board. And you'd think that would be the end of the story when they decided then to just walk away from it, but it's not the end of the story because both of those utilities have rate cases in front of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to increase rates for the customers for millions of dollars for plants that will never be built. It's extremely expensive to plan a coal plant. And the utilities are requesting to charge their customers for all of the costs of those plants, even though the power will never exist because they've since walked away from the plant. So it does have kind of maybe some hidden costs, but they're very real costs. And certainly for Interstate Power and Light, that proposed a 22% increase in the rates for their customers, it has brought all of the cities down there and a lot of customers in line, but I don't think I've ever seen that number of public comments in opposition to a rate case before, and I've been doing this for over 25 years. So it's a big deal in the rates for those customers.
And Senator Benson, you still have to follow up on that?
So it's not the economics that shut down the plants because if they were already built and now they're coming for a rate case, I guess I'm confused.
Chairman, Senator Benson,
Ms. O'Connell.
Thank you. The economics are why the Otter Tail and Interstate Power and Light walked away from their plants. For Otter Tail, I'm more familiar with the facts in that case. When the Public Utilities Commission decided to hold Otter Tail Power to the assumptions that Otter Tail was making in its certificate of need, the company looked at that and said, well, you know, construction costs could go up or carbon costs could go up, and we don't want our shareholders to take that risk. They were okay with ratepayers taking that risk. We were not okay with ratepayers taking that risk. So the commission protected ratepayers from having additional risk, and subsequently Otter Tail walked away. So the economics of having to pay those costs for their shareholders was why they walked away. But they still incurred costs, development costs, and they still want to charge their ratepayers for all of those development costs. I think it's about $10 million for Otter Tail.
Senator Benson.
One more question, Ms. O'Connell. You mentioned the carbon costs. Wouldn't those carbon costs be because of this legislation? And that would be part of the economic failure?
Ms. O'Connell.
Chairman, Senator Benson, no. Actually, the carbon costs were simply, there had to be some level of carbon costs that were put into the analysis, this detailed analysis. And Otter Tail, you know, we asked them to look at different scenarios. What if there is cap and trade? This was back in 2007, 2008. What if there is carbon costs? What are the risks? If Otter Tail believed there was no risk of any carbon costs, and we're talking about national carbon costs because there are actually no charges, no taxes of carbon. It's not a tax that's being applied to these costs. It's simply to say, look at the effects. If you had a $9 to $34, how would that change your planning? And Otter Tail must have felt that there was significant risk to there being some kind of national cost for carbon that made them say, we're not going to take this on. And, you know, construction costs as well. I'm sure it wasn't just carbon.
Okay, then we have Senator Howe, Senator Dibble, and Senator Stumpf. So, Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Grant, I'm wondering if the agency is saying that that we're not going to have new coal plants being built because of the demand for electricity is not there, baseload electricity is not there. I'd like you to speak a little bit to the potential for the litigation if we don't do Senate File 86. And as legislators, you know, we need to do that risk cost benefit analysis. And so if we're not facing going to have new coal plants built and we could face potential litigation, I'm wondering if you could speak to that.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Senator Howe, I said before that I'm not a scientist. I'm also not a lawyer. So I'm not going to offer you a legal opinion. What am I, after all?
We're narrowing it down.
we're getting there.
Thank you, Mr. Grant.
So I can't really comment on whether or not the legal issues that might be brought forward have merit or not. I can tell you that from what our attorney tells me, the fact that we haven't seen a draft complaint from North Dakota is surprising if they really are intending to file suit as quickly as Senator Rosen suggests if we don't pass this bill, because it would be quite customary for a litigant in a case like this to provide that sort of draft of their legal arguments to opposing counsel ahead of making such a filing. So we really don't know at this point specifically which issues would be brought forward. I can tell you that, you know, the attorneys that I have spoken to who have analyzed this tell me that if the question is a Commerce Clause question, that it's unlikely that North Dakota could prevail because the Minnesota law treats Minnesota's power plants every bit the same as it would a North Dakota plant. There is no differential between how a plant proposed here would be treated versus a plant that would intend to import power into Minnesota.
Senator Dibble.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was kind of along the same lines, but I just need to say that I'm not motivated or moved by threats and blackmail from another state. You know, when another state is telling us change your law or else, I think that's inappropriate. And we need to consider the policies of the state that you know benefit the citizens and exercise our good judgment. And other states can think what they will and do what they will. And frankly, if we're spending a lot of time talking to someone who's threatening to sue us, I'm concerned about that too, respectfully, Senator Rosen, because you know there we do have some fiduciary responsibility as well here, and for you know planning out a policy or a legislative strategy with a potential other party, you know we're going to be a defendant against something that they're an action that they're bringing. I'm especially concerned about why and how we're approaching this change.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Senator Rosen, did you want to answer to that? Or?
I'll wait.
Okay. Senator Stumpf?
If I can remember what my question was. anyway, we would like to be good neighbors since we're bordering our good friends to the west. I think it went back to when you said that Otter Tail was trying to increase rates for the cost of a power plant that wasn't built. It reminded me last weekend there was a big article in the paper about why our electric rates are going up 29% up in our area. And the explanation was to comply with the green energy, basically the 25 by 25, I think it was, isn't it? The they had purchased wind power contract with a provider in North Dakota, and I think it was like, I don't know, 4.5 cents or something like that. And then, of course, the bottom fell out of the market, so the electricity that was being generated wasn't worth 4.5 cents. They couldn't sell it for 4.5 cents, basically, so they got about 2 cents for it. So then the consumers had to make up the difference, or the customers. So there's a lot of unhappy people in my district, well, throughout the whole western and northern part of the state, because of the increasing rates. So it seems like the consumer ends up paying one way or the other.
Senator Rosen.
I think sometimes the discussion should go back to what are the needs of Minnesota and where are we heading with our energy needs and our economic development needs in the future. And there's this discussion about baseload energy and whether we need it or not. And frankly, I'm seriously praying the economy turns around very quickly. So we do need some strong energy and baseload energy. Because we can, you know, man cannot live on renewable energy and natural gas alone. We have to fill out that portfolio. And Senator Dibble, I'm sorry if you're offended by a very real threat to North Dakota, but a very real threat could come through from all of our neighboring states too. On this just happens to be North Dakota's situation and their interpretation of the law, and they have been very cordial, trying to discuss that. The governor from North Dakota is talking to our governor here, and I think it's very positive discussions. And I think this is a piece that we need to recognize. It needs to be adjusted and fixed. Some of the cleanest coal is coming out of North Dakota, and it certainly would serve all of Minnesota well.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess you know, disagree with my good friend Senator Dibble that I did meet with the Attorney General of North Dakota as well, and as did the current Lieutenant Governor, Senator Prentner-Solin and Senator Rosen. And I think, what I'm disagreeing about is I think it is productive to have the conversation. And because it's not like we're actually parties to a lawsuit, and then it might be inappropriate, but nothing could be further from the truth, because I don't believe there ever will be a lawsuit either. And I think our non-lawyer, Mr. Grant, did it as a lawyer. Myself, he did a really excellent job of explaining the law as told to him by his lawyer, which is the Commerce Clause is based on discrimination from a home state to a foreign state or a neighboring state. And if you treat everyone the same, there's no violation of the Commerce Clause. And so I understand they've been talking about this for a long time. There's been a lot of meetings, and I appreciate that they came to Minnesota to talk to us about this, and the chief of staff for the governor. And they don't have a case, and I don't believe they will ever file a lawsuit because they don't have the law on their side. I think they're trying to persuade us to change this law because they don't like it. And I did remind them that when we passed the renewable energy standard, we actually provided an additional market for them to sell their wind to Minnesota, because our utilities are in many cases buying wind from North Dakota, which has an abundant wind source. So they've actually benefited from some of those laws, and they seemed very uninterested in that fact, which is really kind of disappointing, that they want to sell us coal. That's human nature. Of course, that's what they want to do. But I don't believe they're ever going to sue us, and I think they're trying to get us to change the law because they don't like it. But I don't think that we should be fearful of that, because I don't think they have a leg to stand on.
Thank you. Senator Vandeveer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if the lawsuit thing influences me or not, but what does is I supported these standards also, and I did so because we were told that if things get, you know, that it's not necessarily etched in stone, that this is something with off-ramps, and if we get into problems and we see that we've got some things here that need adjustment, that we were going to be able to do that. And so we knew it wasn't absolutely a perfect plan, but it put us in a direction many people wanted to go, and that's what we did. But it was never sold to me as being etched in stone. And so I think what we're doing here is very reasonable, and to consider this is just part of the process.
Senator Anderson.
Chair, if I may, I hope we don't forget some of the other testimony that we've been hearing in this committee over the last few weeks, and we've heard from a number of utilities, and we've heard a number of them say that adding renewables as required by the Renewable Energy Standard has helped to keep rates low. Let's not forget that. Those are the people, those are the utilities, those are the ones buying this energy. And there's other factors that are affecting the whole energy market, of course, but there's really nobody has come in from a utility and told us that the Renewable Energy Standard is costing their ratepayers too much money, because if they did, they could go to the Public Utilities Commission through those off-ramps. But nobody has done that.
So
that law does exist. So your utility can do that if that's a genuine problem, but I'm not sure that it is. They're blaming it, but I don't know that the facts support that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, I think the at least the truth is, I mean, what they're saying is happening is that, and it's basically the economy. Mm-hmm. They got a 25-year contract to buy wind power at a higher rate than what they can sell it at. And so, in fact, we heard that same thing over at MISO, that in some generators of electricity can't hardly give the power away because there's more of it produced. And that, and I'm not opposed to wind power at all. I think it's a great source of power. What I think... And I think the co-ops operate differently, and I'm a new member on the committee, so I don't really, you know, understand all the intricacies. Because I don't think you see before the PUC. I don't think the co-ops go before the PUC. I think they're outside of that. But if the economy picked up and the demand for electricity goes up, then I think the cost to the ratepayers would go down.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Senator Anderson.
And Senator Stumpf, if they had, instead of buying this wind power, had invested in a coal plant, the same exact thing could have happened. If demand goes down, they're stuck with that investment, and they have to pay for it, and they don't have enough demand for the electricity. So I don't know that you can say it's the fault of wind power. It's the fault of the economy that's reducing demand for electricity in general, that's jeopardizing those investments that companies have made.
Well, and in some ways it's a fault of a futures contract. You bet on, you make a 25-year contract betting that supply will be a fair value, and you're stuck with that contract. So, anyway, if there's no more questions, we look forward to Tuesday for the opposition to the bill, and I certainly look forward to someone bringing me that science on CO2. It would be great and wonderful for me. So having no more business today, the committee is adjourned.